Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. Bruno came up with an idea for an innovative approach to forecasting, an econometric model based on the writings of a turn-of-the-century Russian mathematician. The model involved assigning subjective probabilities to predictions that certain specific sectors of an economy would grow. John could see that this had the potential to be an ideal tool to justify the inflated rates of increase they'd like to show in order to obtain large loans, and Bruno asked John to see what he could do with the concept. John brought a young MIT mathematician, Dr. Nadipuram Prasad, into his department and gave him a budget. Within 6 months, he developed the Markov method for econometric modeling. Together, they hammered out a series of technical papers that presented Markov as a revolutionary method for forecasting the impact of infrastructure investment on economic development. It was exactly what they wanted, a tool that scientifically proved they were doing countries a favor by helping them incur debts they would never be able to pay off. In addition, only a highly skilled econometrician with lots of time and money could possibly comprehend the intricacies of Markov or question its conclusions. The papers were published by several prestigious organizations, and they formally presented them at conferences and universities in a number of countries. The papers became famous throughout the industry. Omar Torrijos and John honored their secret agreement. John made sure their studies were honest and that their recommendations took into account the poor. Although John heard grumbling that his forecasts in Panama were not up to their usual inflated standards, and even that they smacked of socialism, the fact was that Maine kept winning contracts from Torrijos' government. These contracts included a first to provide innovative master plans that involved agriculture along with the more traditional infrastructure sectors. John also watched from the sidelines as Torrijos and Jimmy Carter set out to renegotiate the canal treaty. The canal negotiations generated great interest and great passions around the world. People everywhere waited to see whether the United States would do what most of the rest of the world believed was the right thing, allow the Panamanians to take control, or would instead try to reestablish our global version of Manifest Destiny, which had been shaken by our Vietnam debacle. For many, it appeared that a reasonable and compassionate man had been elected to the U.S. presidency at the right time. However, the conservative bastions of Washington and the pulpits of the religious right rang with indignation. How could the U.S. give up this bulwark of national defense, this symbol of U.S. ingenuity, this ribbon of water that tied South America's fortunes to the whims of U.S. commercial interests? During John's trips to Panama, he became accustomed to staying at the Hotel Continental. However, on his fifth visit, he moved across the street to the Hotel Panama because the Continental was undergoing renovations and the construction was very noisy. At first, John resented the inconvenience. The Continental had been his home away from home. But now, the expansive lobby where he sat, with its rattan chairs and paddle-bladed wooden ceiling fans, was growing on him. It could have been the set of Casablanca, and he fantasized that Humphrey Bogart might stroll in at any moment. John set down the copy of the New York Review of Books, in which he had just finished reading a Graham Greene article about Panama, and stared up at those fans, recalling an evening almost 2 years earlier. Ford is a weak president who won't be reelected, Omar Torrijos predicted in 1975. He was speaking to a group of influential Panamanians. John was one of the few foreigners who had been invited to the elegant old club with its whirring ceiling fans. That's the reason I decided to accelerate this canal issue. It's a good time to launch an all-out political battle to win it back, said Torrijos. The speech inspired John. He returned to his hotel room and scratched out a letter that he eventually mailed to the Boston Globe. Back in Boston, an editor responded by calling John at his office to request that he write an op-ed piece. Colonialism in Panama has no place in 1975, took up nearly half the page opposite the editorials in the September 19, 1975 edition. The article cited three specific reasons for transferring the canal to Panama. First, the present situation is unjust, a good reason for any decision. Second, the existing treaty creates far graver security risks than would result from turning more control over to the Panamanians. John referenced a study conducted by the Interoceanic Canal Commission, which concluded that traffic could be halted for 2 years by a bomb planted, conceivably by one man, in the side of the Gatun Dam, a point General Torrijos himself had publicly emphasized. And third, the present situation is creating serious problems for already troubled United States-Latin American relations. John ended with the following quote, which I will get into after a station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. John Perkins' quote, then, is, "The best way of assuring the continued and efficient operation of the canal is to help Panamanians gain control over and responsibility for it. In so doing, we could take pride in initiating an action that would reaffirm commitments to the cause of self-determination to which we pledged ourselves 200 years ago. Colonialism was in vogue at the turn of the century, the early 1900s, as it had been in 1775. Perhaps ratification of such a treaty could be understood in the context of those times. Today, it is without justification. Colonialism has no place in 1975. We, celebrating our bicentennial, should realize this and act accordingly. That's the end of the quote. Writing that piece was a bold move on John's part, especially since he had recently been made a partner at Maine. Partners were expected to avoid the press and certainly to refrain from publishing political diatribes on the editorial page of New England's most prestigious newspaper. John received, through interoffice mail, a pile of nasty, mostly anonymous notes stapled to copies of the article. He was certain that he recognized the handwriting on one as that of Charlie Illingworth. John's first project manager had been at Maine for over 10 years, compared to less than 5 for him, and was not as yet a partner. A fierce skull and crossbone figured prominently on the note, and its message was simple. Is this commie really a partner in our firm? Bruno summoned John to his office and said, "You'll get loads of grief over this. Maine's a pretty conservative place. But I want you to know I think you're smart. Torrijos will love it. I do hope you're sending him a copy." "Good. Well, these jokers here in this office, the ones who think Torrijos is a socialist, really won't give a damn as long as the work flows in." Bruno had been right, as usual. Now it was 1977, Carter was in the White House, and serious canal negotiations were underway. Many of Maine's competitors had taken the wrong side and had been turned out of Panama, but John's work had multiplied, and he was sitting in the lobby of the Hotel Panama, having just finished reading an article by Graham Greene in the New York Review of Books. The article, "The Country with 5 Frontiers," was a gutsy piece that included a discussion of corruption among senior officers in Panama's National Guard. The author pointed out that the general himself admitted to giving many of his staff special privileges, such as superior housing, because if I don't pay them, the CIA will. The clear implication was that the U.S. intelligence community was determined to undermine the wishes of President Carter and, if necessary, would bribe Panama's military chiefs into sabotaging the treaty negotiations. John could not help but wonder if the jackals had begun to circle Torrijos. John had seen a photograph in the People section of Time, or Newsweek, of Torrijos and Green sitting together. The caption indicated that the writer was a special guest who had become a good friend. John wondered how the general felt about this novelist, whom he apparently trusted, writing such a critique. Graham Greene's article raised another question, one that related to that day in 1972, when John had sat across a coffee table from Torrijos. At the time, John had assumed that Torrijos knew the foreign aid game was there to make him rich while shackling his country with debt. John had been sure he knew that the process was based on the assumption that men in power are corruptible, and that his decision not to seek personal benefit, but rather to use foreign aid to truly help his people, would be seen as a threat that might eventually topple the entire system. The world was watching this man. His actions had ramifications that reached far beyond Panama and would therefore not be taken lightly. John wondered how the corporatocracy would react if loans made to Panama helped the poor without contributing to impossible debts. Now, John wondered whether Torrijos regretted the deal he and John had struck that day, and John wasn't sure how he felt about those deals himself. John had stepped back from his economic hitman role. John had played Torrijos' game instead of his own, accepting Torrijos' insistence on honesty in exchange for more contracts. In purely economic terms, it had been a wise business decision for Maine. Nonetheless, it had been inconsistent with what Claudine had instilled in John. It was not advancing the global empire. Had it now unleashed the jackals? John recalled thinking, when he left Torrijos' bungalow that day, that Latin American history is littered with dead heroes. A system based on corrupting public figures does not take kindly to public figures who refuse to be corrupted. Then John thought his eyes were playing tricks. A familiar figure was walking slowly across the lobby. At first, he was so confused that he believed it was Humphrey Bogart, but Bogart was long deceased. Then he recognized the man ambling past him as one of the great figures in modern English literature, author of The Power and the Glory, The Comedians, Our Man in Havana, and of the article John had just set down on the table next to him. Graham Greene hesitated a moment, peered around, and headed for the coffee shop. John was tempted to call out or to run after him, but John stopped himself. An inner voice said Greene needed his privacy. Another warned that Greene would shun John. John picked up the New York Review of Books and was surprised a moment later to discover that he was standing in the doorway to the coffee shop. John had breakfasted earlier that morning, and the maitre d' gave John an odd look. John glanced around. Graham Greene sat alone at a table near the wall. John pointed to the table beside him. "Over there," John told the maitre d'. "Can I sit there for another breakfast?" John was always a good tipper. The maitre d' smiled knowingly and led him to the table. The novelist was absorbed in his newspaper. John ordered coffee and a croissant with honey. John wanted to discover Greene's thoughts about Panama, Torrijos, and the Canal Affair, but had no idea how to initiate such a conversation. Then Greene looked up to take a sip from his glass. "Excuse me," John said. Greene glared at John, or so it seemed. "Yes? I hate to intrude, but you are Graham Greene, aren't you?" "Why, yes, indeed." Greene smiled warmly. "Most people in Panama don't recognize me." John gushed that he was John's favorite novelist, and then gave Greene a brief life history, including John's work at Maine and his meetings with Torrijos. Greene asked if John was the consultant who had written an article about the United States getting out of Panama. "In the Boston Globe, if I recall correctly," Greene asked. John was flabbergasted. "A courageous thing to do, given your position," Greene said. "Won't you join me?" John moved to his table and sat there with Greene for what must have been an hour and a half. John realized, as they chatted, how very close to Torrijos Greene had grown. Greene spoke of the general at times like a father speaking about his son. And I will return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from CREW-LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. "The general," Greene said, "invited me to write a book about his country. I'm doing just that. This one will be nonfiction, something a bit off the line for me." John asked him why he usually wrote novels instead of nonfiction. "Fiction is safer," he said. "Most of my subject matter is controversial. Vietnam, Haiti, the Mexican Revolution. A lot of publishers would be afraid to publish nonfiction about these matters." He pointed at the New York Review of Books, where it lay on the table John had vacated. "Words like those can cause a great deal of damage." Then Greene smiled. "Besides, I like to write fiction. It gives me much greater freedom." He looked at John intensely. "The important thing is to write about things that matter, like your Globe article about the canal." Greene's admiration for Torrijos was obvious. It seemed that Panama's head of state could impress a novelist every bit as much as he impressed the poor and dispossessed. Equally obvious was Greene's concern for his friend's life. "It's a huge endeavor," Greene explained, "taking on the giant of the North." He shook his head sadly. "I fear for his safety." Then it was time for Greene to leave. "Must catch a flight to France," he said, rising slowly and shaking John's hand. Greene peered into John's eyes. "Why don't you write a book?" He gave John an encouraging nod. "It's in you. But remember, make it about things that matter." He turned and walked away. Then Green stopped and came back a few steps into the restaurant. "Don't worry," Green said. "The general will prevail. He'll get the canal back." Torrijos did get it back. In that same year, 1977, he successfully negotiated new treaties with President Carter that transferred the canal zone and the canal itself over to Panamanian control. Then the White House had to convince the U.S. Congress to ratify it. A long and arduous battle ensued. In the final tally, the canal treaty was ratified by a single vote. Conservatives swore revenge. When Graham Greene's nonfiction book, Getting to Know the General, came out years later, it was dedicated to the friends of my friend, Omar Torrijos, in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Panama. Then John continues with Iran. Between 1975 and 1978, John frequently visited Iran. Sometimes he commuted between Latin America or Indonesia and Tehran. The Shah of Shahs, literally King of Kings, his official title, presented a completely different situation from that in the other countries where Main worked. Iran was oil rich, and like Saudi Arabia, it did not need to incur debt in order to finance its ambitious list of projects. However, Iran differs significantly from Saudi Arabia in that its large population, while predominantly Middle Eastern and Muslim, was not Arabic. In addition, the country had a history of political turmoil, both internally and in its relationships with its neighbors. Therefore, the U.S. took a different approach. Washington and the business community joined forces to turn the Shah into a symbol of progress. The U.S. launched an immense effort to show the world what a strong, democratic friend of U.S. corporate and political interests could accomplish. Never mind his obviously undemocratic title or the less obvious fact of the CIA orchestrated coup against his democratically elected premier, Washington and its European partners were determined to present the Shah's government as an alternative to those of Iraq, Libya, China, Korea, and other nations where a powerful undercurrent of anti-Americanism was surfacing. To all appearances, the Shah was a progressive friend of the underprivileged. In 1962, he ordered large private land holdings broken up and turned over to peasant owners. The following year, he inaugurated his White Revolution, which involved an extensive agenda for socioeconomic reforms. The power of OPEC grew during the 1970s, and the Shah became an increasingly influential world leader. At the same time, Iran developed one of the most powerful military forces in the Muslim Middle East. Main was involved in projects that covered most of the country, from tourist areas along the Caspian Sea in the north to secret military installations overlooking the Straits of Hormuz in the south. Once again, the focus of Main's work was to forecast regional development potentials and then to design electrical generating, transmission, and distribution systems that would provide the all-important energy required to fuel the industrial and commercial growth that would realize these forecasts. John visited most of the major regions of Iran at one time or another. He followed the old caravan trail through the desert mountains from Kirman to Bandar Abbas, and John roamed the ruins of Persepolis, the legendary palace of ancient kings, and one of the wonders of the classical world. John toured the country's most famous and spectacular sites, Shiraz, Isfahan, and the magnificent tent city near Persepolis, where the Shah had been crowned. In the process, John developed a genuine love for this land and its complex people. On the surface, Iran seemed to be a model example of Christian-Muslim cooperation. However, John soon learned that tranquil appearances may mask deep resentment. Late one evening in 1977, John returned to his hotel room to find a note shoved under his door. He was shocked to discover that it was signed by a man named Yamin. John had never met him, but he had been described to John during a government briefing as a famous and most subversive radical. In a beautifully crafted English script, the note invited John to meet him at a designated restaurant. However, there was a warning. John was to come only if he was interested in exploring a side of Iran that most people in his position never saw. John wondered whether Yamin knew what his true position was. John realized that he was taking a big risk. However, John could not resist the temptation to meet this enigmatic figure. John's taxi dropped him off in front of a tiny gate in a high wall, so high that John could not see the building behind it. A beautiful Iranian woman wearing a long black gown ushered John in and led him down a corridor illuminated by ornate oil lamps hanging from a low ceiling. At the end of this corridor, they entered a room that dazzled like the interior of a diamond, blinding John with its radiance. When his eyes finally adjusted, John saw that the walls were inlaid with semi-precious stones and mother-of-pearl. The restaurant was lighted by tall white candles protruding from intricately sculpted bronze chandeliers. A tall man with long black hair, wearing a tailored navy blue suit, approached and shook John's hand. He introduced himself as Yamin in an accent that suggested he was an Iranian who had been educated in the British school system, and John was immediately struck by how little he looked like a subversive radical. Yamin directed John past several tables where couples sat quietly eating to a very private alcove. Yamin assured John they could talk in complete confidentiality. John had the distinct impression that this restaurant catered to secret rendezvous. Theirs, quite possibly, was the only non-amorous one that night. Yasmin was very cordial. During their discussion, it became obvious that he thought of John merely as an economic consultant, not as someone with ulterior motives. Yamin explained that he had singled John out because he knew John had been a Peace Corps volunteer and because he had been told that John took every possible opportunity to get to know the country and to mix with its people. "You are very young compared to most in your profession," he said to John. "You have a genuine interest in our history and our current problems. You represent our hope." This, as well as the setting, his appearance, and the presence of so many others in the restaurant, gave John a certain degree of comfort. John had become accustomed to people befriending him, like Rossi in Java and Fidel in Panama, and John accepted it as a compliment and an opportunity. He knew that he stood out from other Americans because he was, in fact, infatuated with the places he visited. John found that people warm to you very quickly if you open your eyes, ears, and heart to their culture. Yasmin asked if John knew about the Flowering Desert Project. "The Shah believes that our deserts were once fertile plains and lush forests. At least, that's what he claims. During Alexander the Great's reign, according to this theory, vast armies swept across these lands, traveling with millions of goats and sheep. The animals ate all the grass and other vegetation. The disappearance of these plants caused a drought, and eventually the entire region became a desert. Now, all we have to do, or so the Shah says, is plant millions upon millions of trees. After that, presto, the rains will return and the desert will bloom again. Of course, in the process, we will have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars." He smiled condescendingly. "Companies like yours will reap huge profits." And we will continue the story of Confessions of an Economic Hitman in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from CREW-LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.